You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.
Hello, I'm Alan Committee, a part-time comedian and a full-time chairperson of the Lee Barnard Appreciation Society in parts of northern Blairgowrie.
Hooray!
Welcome to the very first edition of The Dan Nichols Show Global Luxury Deluxe Podcast. Now, if you're listening to this, you're probably thinking, well, this is brand new technology. What on earth is a podcast? I am indeed one of the first people globally to have come up with this idea, and I'm very proud of it. When I sat and I spoke to my producer, Simi, who is a failed comedian but quite good at producing podcasts, he said, go for a big star, get a really big name. Let's get in an Oprah, let's get in a Denzel, maybe a De Niro. And I thought, no, I'm a man of the people. Let me get a friend who nobody really knows, no one's really heard of. And of course, I haven't done that at all because I've got someone who's both Alan Committee.
What a delight. This is nice. For the listener at home, we're sitting opposite each other, a beautiful wooden crafted table in the middle of a shopping mall. This couldn't be better. I mean, it could be better in 100,000 ways. But I'll tell you what's perfect about it is seeing your little face. I haven't seen it for far too long. And here we are able to chat for at least 6 or 7 minutes. Uninterrupted, I'm hoping.
And celebrate you, because that's what I want to do first of all.
Oh, go on.
For too long, for me, you have been seen as this kind of sex symbol, stand-up comedian, makes people laugh, no substance whatsoever as an entertainer. And over the last little while, you have been rocking, and I use that term deliberately, Amadeus. you've come in looking like you've been on prison break, but it's actually Amadeus.
Correct.
And it's one of the things I love most about Alan Committee is that you are this wonderful chameleon of a performer in that you're not just incredibly funny, as you point out on a regular basis, but you've also got this absolute love of doing drama. And you've done it plenty of times. You've done lots of Shakespeare. But now doing Amadeus, which I know you've been so passionate about, it's a completely different side to the Alan Committee everyone knows.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, maybe in Joburg more so than in Cape Town. Cape Town, where I spent the last 15 years of my career, I've kind of now slowly started to teach the audience that when I started out, it was as an actor, first and foremost. My love was really for live performance and whatever that encapsulated. Of course, I had a passion for comedy, and I was lucky enough to kind of move from one-man theater shows into stand-up comedy. But even in those shows, as you know, you've seen enough of them, mostly on comps, but that's fine.
People pay for your shows?
What?
What is this concept?
Breaking news. But the idea, even with the stand-up shows, is that they have a theatricality to them. It's not just a man with a microphone and a spotlight, that there are sketches and lighting, that there's a narrative to the script. And all of that comes from my passion for theatre and for live performance. And having studied all those many years ago at UCT, the idea has always been to kind of traverse and straddle those two worlds, the world of theatre and comedy. And I guess lucky enough to do fairly well at comedy and corporate work and corporate comedy means that I'm able to, I call it an indulgence, but in the best sense of the word, indulge in one or two passion projects. And over the years, that has included a Richard III at Maynardville, or Oliana, a brilliant David Mamet, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, one of the great playwrights, I think, of the 20th century, Tom Stoppard. But right at the top of that list was Peter Schaffer's play Amadeus. Man, I fell in love with it back in 1997 when I was still a teacher at Westerford in Cape Town, and I got a chance to direct the production at school level. You know, I was directing matric and grade 11 students. And that in itself was a stretch. And working on that text, I suddenly realized one day I have to play Salieri if I get an opportunity. Well, cut to 23 odd years later, I finally have the chance and I'm loving every single moment of it. I got to tell you, Dan, sometimes, as you know, we get caught up in the madness of all the stuff that we end up doing. And you're, like me, also have your fingers in all kinds of pies and sometimes your mouth in them as well. But that's for a different podcast. And the truth is, we don't always enjoy in the moment the fact that we are doing these things. You, for example, straddling around the world and talking to these incredible sports stars and being able to kind of live your passion for sport and celebrity and philanthropy and all of those good things. But how often do we actually in the moment get to stop and go, hang on, I'm doing this. I'm talking to this person. I'm speaking these words for me. This last week alone, twice in the middle of performance, I've had the thought of, man, this is exciting. I'm doing this. And I'm really pleased about that because for me, that has to be part of it. Otherwise, I'm not sure why we do all of this, because there's enough stress and pressures around it to get it up and running.
And the fact that you are now, you know, closing in on your late 70s. You've been working out for so long, and yet the guy opposite me looks like a kid.
Oh,
as
bless
you talk
you.
About Amadeus. You are so excited.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're still so excited so long into this career.
Yeah, I think so. I think we've got to find our passion points and those things that do tickle our ivories and whatever those are inside us. And, you know, for me, you know me well enough over the years, cricket is my big passion. You can give me all kinds of amazing plays and stand-up comedy stars, but if you tell me I'm going to meet X from the cricketing world, that gets me going. But there are a couple of touch points in my career, and again, Amadeus just happens to be one of them. It's such an amazing text, and it was written back in 1979. Honestly, it feels like it could have been written last week. It hasn't dated at all. Jeff Hyland, who directed the show, I've worked with him a couple of times. I think he's done a superb job at editing the text and creating a version of it for 8 actors. It's normally with 16. And we're telling the story in a way that I'm very proud of. And clearly the audience is responding well. So that in itself obviously makes it easier. But it's been exciting. We've been in Joburg now for 4 or 5 weeks with the show. We're about to finish. We've got 2 weeks left. And then we're off to Cape Town for a 6-week run. So I've still got a bit more of this glow that can live with me for a while. Yeah.
Now, you're only able to do this, to have a success on stage, because of your dismal failure in your previous career, which was as a teacher.
Yeah.
And I was never taught by you, but I have this vision of you as a teacher being absolutely entertaining and completely woeful, because I would have walked out of my chemistry class being able to deliver 8 fabulous lines when I got home, really funny, and knowing absolutely nothing about the periodic table. Was that, Alan, the teacher?
It's as if you were there in my class. That's exactly the problem. My sister, Lisa, back in Cape Town, is also a teacher, or certainly taught for 25 years at primary school level. And I just know, having spent a bit of time with her and seeing her teach, but also from the feedback from all the many, many parents that had kids go through her classes, how brilliant she was. She's the real deal. She's the proper pedagogue in the family. Me, all I really did, I realized looking back over those 8 years, was to learn a lot of skills that has stood me in good stead for stand-up comedy and live theater. In other words, holding the attention of a group of people, reading a group of people or a class, trying to be clear about how you communicate stuff. And all of those good things really have been brilliant for my stand-up world and even in the corporate world, facilitating and emceeing conferences. But as for educating and the kids, I think they had a good laugh, but that must be where it starts.
There were just many, many kids. It was at Westerford you talked
about. At Westerford and at Herschel and at Weinberg Senior Secondary for 2 terms.
Because there's a whole group of kids in that kind of age group who matriculated at about 26, 27.
That's right.
Very, very entertaining, but had learned nothing.
Nothing.
Under Mr. Committee.
Well, there's a huge vacuum in the education strata, and that's partly my doing. Listen, it was an incredible, when I look back at it, none of this was planned. I don't think many of us really can plan that fastidiously. What was a good word for a podcast? Looking forward. But when I look back, I kind of go, how lucky was I for those first 6 or 7 years of my stand-up and professional acting career? I had a part-time job at those schools where I was able to earn a little bit of extra money and put some money towards what was later going to be my stand-up shows, and B, to learn those skills. And this was the thing that's probably most valuable, and I certainly didn't realize it at the time, was to realize the kind of little small crowd or following that I was building. Because the parents of those kids who then came to watch my first couple of shows back in 98, 99, 2000, luckily those shows were enough of a quality that they came back again and again and then spread the word. So that by the time I entered the industry officially, I had 600 or 700 people who knew who I was and could spread the word. And if that sounds like a small number, the problem today with a lot of young comics and performers who come to me and say, how do you start? I go, I don't know how in a world filled with so much noise and so many products and so many things happening, how you even get 400 or 500 people to acknowledge that you're doing something, to like it and make the effort to come back the next time to watch again. And that happened purely serendipitously. And so I'm very grateful to that, because that was the kickstart that I needed to get going.
It's also, it's scary. If I think back, I left world of journalism and radio and phoned my mother and told her I was going to be an MC and a presenter, and terribly famous, and live in Barbados with Kardashians and a jacuzzi. And I think she just wept for about a week.
Yeah.
And it kind of worked out in the end. But it's a scary step to take. I guess your push was the fact that probably the school was quite happy to see the back of you.
Yeah.
But what was that like? What was that moment that said, right,
so
let's
do it?
It
was always the plan. I mean, the teaching was a stepping stone for me. And I was always teaching part-time. I got to a point at Herschel, I think, I can't remember what the contract was, but let's say 100 hours a year I had to teach. And I could spread that out across in kind of conversation with the head of drama at the time. And it got to the point by the last year of teaching where I sat in front of the headmistress going, I have to do the last 100 hours of this year to fulfill my contract because I've been doing so many other things. And she was amazing. She just said, I think the time has come now. Go, go. I think that's how she said it. It might have been, get out. I forget the exact details.
Three large security guys yeah, clearing your desk.
all women. And so it was, yeah, for me, it was a kind of, it was always part of a plan. But you're right, when you do go out into the big wide world, and especially of freelance live entertainment, I mean, certainly those first 4 or 5 years, you don't, you've got that mad thing where you're trying to, you want to be as busy as possible and book ahead, but you don't want to book too far ahead because you don't know what the next big thing is that you want to be available for. And that juggling act was quite stressful. I think one of the reasons you and I have gravitated towards each other, and we've known each other for many years now, is that we have a very similar work ethic in the sense that there's very little that we won't go, oh, let's try that, or let's give that a go and give it a good go and then be able to assess, is this something that's got a future or not? And I think that was one of the things that stood me instead, and I've certainly seen it in your career. We've jumped onto a couple of things, we've given a good go, and every now and then they've hit a mother load and you've gone, oh, this is fantastic. So that kind of working and as hard as we could in my 20s and 30s, I think now has paid off. I'm now at a stage where I can relax a little bit and breathe and go, okay, these are the projects I want to work on. Those are the things I don't have to work on anymore.
And it does look like you're relaxing because halfway through the year, not even halfway through the year, I think you've done 91 different productions. You run an 8-day. You don't relax at all, Alan Committee.
I do. I have started now as I get old. How old are you now, Dan? Are we allowed to talk about this on the podcast?
We are. Well, this is such new technology that by the time it's edited, we might be much older. I'm 45.
You're 45, and I turned 50 this year. And I don't know if you... Because I know we knew each other in our 30s and we were...
Biblically.
Exactly. It was a very tender and beautiful affair.
Short-lived.
And
wonderful.
Short-lived. But those couple of minutes were some of the best of my life. But the point is that we had the energy and the enthusiasm and we could... You know, I would take gigs in the middle of gigs. I remember doing one in Durban where I had two functions, one on one floor and one on the other. I hadn't told them about it. And emceeing the one and then ran downstairs to do a 45-minute set in the other. You know, and we would do those mad things. I think as we get a bit older and, you know, maybe it's a silly trope, but the truth is you do want to kind of relax. And I am now starting to enjoy, you know, those moments where I can, in between projects, or as I referenced earlier, sometimes while I'm doing a project, just actually breathe and enjoy it. Because I'm starting to believe that's part of the thing that keeps us healthy and happy. That doesn't mean there isn't those mad days of frantic hustling and haggling.
Yeah, look, my mind is completely different. My motivation is obviously nowhere near the same. Mine is simply my wife saying, oh, darling, my mother's coming around for dinner. Ah, yes, I'm off to Karachi.
That's right.
I've got an accountancy conference that I'm hosting.
My family now know that finally, it's taken them 20-odd years, that when I say I've got a rehearsal, that actually on Christmas Day after lunch, that's probably not true, but it's certainly a great excuse to get out of any...
I was thinking as I was weaving my way through the charms and delights of Johannesburg traffic this morning about some of our early encounters.
Yeah.
And before we talk about cricket, because that will dominate the rest
correct.
Of our conversation.
That's really why we're here.
I don't know if you remember this. You were doing an evening at the Mount Nelson.
I remember this well.
The Pink Palace. And yes. I was there. I might even had a date with me.
I think you did, sir.
Which was very unusual.
Yes.
It probably involved a credit card transaction. But anyway, having a date, and sitting in the front row, and I was, I think I was showing off, saying, yeah, I know Alan. I've got his pager number, because that's kind of the era we were in. And halfway through, you were leaving. leaving your normal show to bring in your famous, bespectacled and toothed Afrikaans traffic officer.
Johan van der Walt.
Johan van der Walt, who's become an absolute cult icon in South Africa. And your exact words were, I need a quick moment to change. Dan Nicol will entertain you in the meantime. You tossed me the microphone into the front row.
You did pretty well.
I did 45 minutes.
You did 45 minutes.
I couldn't get
me off. 37 of them were hilarious. The opening number where you sang...
Bette Midler.
I mean, that was beautiful, but probably not appropriate. I remember that well.
And why I really remember that, I've never told you this, was that you at that stage, you were already kind of semi-iconic. And people might vaguely recognize you in a shopping center. I was nowhere near that level of anybody having a clue. And the fact that you had, in a very expensive show, tossed me the microphone. It was an unexpected but quite cool vote of faith.
Man, it was fun. Didn't you write for, was it iAfrica back then?
I did indeed.
Yeah, those were the days. And of course, you had a career in, you know, radio, and you'd done some... I just remember that you were as quick-witted as the people that... I tend to gravitate towards people whose minds work. Mark Banks talks about 8-track when you're doing sound... You know, they work on many levels, and they don't all... Sometimes simultaneously...
Mark Banks is 16-track minimum.
Absolutely.
There are a lot of voices in that head.
A lot of voices, and none of them is. but yeah, I remember when I first met you, and even the way you wrote... was it just spoke to someone who understood not only live performance but kind of passion, and but certainly your thing for comedy was great, and I remember that's how we kind of connected early on. Well, that's right, that was at the Mount Nelson. That was great
indeed. And then of course there were endless conversations about cricket, and right at the start you mentioned the great Lee Barnard.
Oh my goodness.
Now if you're thinking, well, who on earth is Lee Barnard?
Who's thinking that?
Well, probably members of Lee Barnard's family, let alone anybody else. I had to Google him when you told me about him. We had probably the most fun we had during lockdown was our cricket show.
Correct.
To an audience of sometimes a dozen.
Whoa.
Mostly accidentally, where we spoke about our love of cricket. And our love of cricket, I think, is a little different to a lot of people who love cricket today, and I'm not knocking them at all. I mean, we are entirely. But the team T20 buzz and instant gratification, yep, of life in general, a lot of cricket. Now, we're very different. We're the 5-day test match, 100%. Dress up in your whites.
Correct.
Just obsessed with it, and probably enhanced by the fact that both of us secretly wish we were ever so slightly better at cricket than we actually are.
Man, ain't that the truth? And I suddenly realized the other day, and I know you feel the same, when you look at cricketers now, there's still a notion at 50 years old, there's still a tiny little part of me that believes I could still be discovered and maybe play, if not international. I'm not an idiot. I'm a realist. Certainly at provincial level. And yet I look at the cricketers and I realize I'm already 15 years too old. I should be retired by 15 years. How can one live with such delusion? And yet we do. It's a madness. Yeah, my love for cricket, it's weird because when I was in primary school, I wasn't a big sports fan. And in fact, I was the kind of... you know, quintessential nerdy, book loving, and in my head a lot, and kind of dreaming up plays and creative stuff. And I remember it was a bit of a disappointment to my dad, who was a big sports fan and had played for Northern Rhodesia football and played a bit of squash and loved cricket. And finally, in my standard six, he kind of persuaded me to join him at Newlands. And I don't know what clicked, but it certainly clicked. And from that moment on, from my grade 8, then standard 6, I haven't missed a day of the test cricket at Newlands over that New Year's period. There have been one or two times when they've changed the dates where I haven't been able to make it, but I have seen every single day except for 3 days, which was when I was in London, and that's when Ben Stokes, yeah. And they scored all those runs, and we still managed to draw that test because Umla made a big 200. But other than that, I haven't missed a day of cricket. And like you, I have a huge passion for the nuances and just the ebb and flow of a lazy day at Newlands from the 2nd to the 6th in beautiful sunshine. No matter what pace the game is happening at, there's something interesting to discuss or watch or even slightly doze off to if it's a very, very slow session and Greg Shepherd was playing for the Australian Rebel team and nothing was happening. Those days are I live for, man, and I look forward to them every single December as we lead into the new year, January period.
So this is where I have troubles with my wife. There are many. And
yes.
She will
list she's spoken about that. It's one of the things frequently. I have to talk about. She sent a list.
Where she is Greek.
Right.
And she's a lawyer. So first of all, I win lots of arguments at home. secondly, the Greeks have many, many fabulous qualities to them. a vested love of cricket is not part of the Greek culture. We've kind of got Nick Pothos, Marcus Stoinis, and then it kind of grinds to a very quick halt.
Right.
And so I've dragged her to an occasional T20 game where between fireworks and large volumes of inexpensive red wine, she's just about gone through it all. But when I settle down to watch day four on a flat track in Dunedin at 2 a.m.
That's right.
And they're scoring at 1 and over.
Yeah.
And I'm genuinely enthralled by it.
100%.
I think she questions her choice of husband on a fairly regular basis, but this really takes it into another level.
Listen, and I've seen you, because I do follow you on Twitter, and I know this is to be true. You're not, you know, exaggerating there. You have on occasion at 3 a.m. going, this is an extraordinary moment. And I'm the only idiot who's following you and can like you, like that post at that point, going, yeah, I'm with you, buddy.
I remember this. I suspect that this podcast concept that I've come up with is going to be the downfall of me. I remember meeting a rather attractive girl from another school when I was growing up in Zimbabwe, and she was the first team scorer. And being a fairly naive sort, I thought this was because she loved cricket. Fast forward, I then meet her down in Cape Town when I started university, and my naivety is still pretty firmly in place, and I'm all very excited by the bright lights and what was then electricity and running water. And we got chatting, and I was very excited. I remembered, of course, she was the cricket scorer, and I still remember suggesting to her that I was well-connected enough that I could possibly get her an introduction to the Western Province Scorers Association.
Man, look at you, Casanova.
She looked at me with such utter contempt. I think her name was Lisa. She's where you are in the world. If you're listening to this, which you probably are, because, yeah, it's my podcast, and I apologize. You probably had these visions of, you know, being happily married to me by now, and instead you discovered what a cricket nerd. I still am.
Still am, yeah. And even now, you know, you and I doing our podcast during lockdown was 2 full tosses.
Yes.
And we did take a quite harsh disdain for IPL and all things T20, which we were right about, of course. But even with that disdain, every now and then I have to watch. I mean, the IPL's up and running now. And if there's no other cricket on, it just kind of alleviates a slight fix, doesn't it?
It's and again, it taps into something that goes back to both of our respective childhoods. And yours was probably highlighted by, I always love you retelling this, and I know you actually randomly stop people in shopping centres and just tell them, can I let you know about the time I played cricket with Herschel Gibbs?
Yeah.
And now Herschel doesn't remember this because I think he would have been 12, 13
at the time. To be fair, Herschel doesn't remember last week. Well, but that's a different...
He probably just had a big night out the night before. But so you were playing against Herschel Gibbs.
That's right.
And you took what... it normally takes about 8 minutes for you to tell the story of this.
Well, I'll do a quick version, which is essentially Westerford were playing bishops. And Westerford should never be playing bishops in any sport. It was a pre-season game. It was their first team playing our first team. Well, our first team could barely cobble together 11.
First eight.
That's right. First eight plus 3 people who'd walked too slowly past him off cricket ground and seconded into the side. And I remember Warren Cole, if he's listening, he won't be. He was bowling what he regarded as off-spin, but it was a series of full tosses at various heights. And he bowled one that happened to drop below the waist. So that's important because it wasn't a no ball. Herschel Gibbs, who was already on 178 of about 38 deliveries, smashed it, but mistimed it, as only Herschel can do occasionally. And I was down in the deep mid-wicket boundary. The ball came high to me. I'd love to say that I ran 35 metres, dived full length, and caught it left-handed. But in fact, what it did is it came straight to me, bounced through my hands, hit my chest, up onto my chin, and then recoiled back into my hand. And I had caught Herschel Gibbs out. And I will always live with that beautiful memory.
Oh, I think that's defined your cricket career.
Yes, it really has.
You've dined on it ever since. And now Amadeus has defined your acting career up until now, which begs the question, when you get to do what you have always dreamed of doing, what's left?
That's a very good question. And it's something I've been thinking about, you know, the last month or so, because I've certainly done a lot of the kind of bucket list plays that I want to do. I'm very lucky in that I've done 26 stand-up shows over 26 years, and those delight me. So that I can easily continue with, because every year I try and do a brand new stand-up show, and that has its own, each year will bring its own sense of material and what's in the zeitgeist and what's worth talking about. But in terms of, yeah, what is next? I think our task is to kind of, I've always worked with a kind of 4 or 5 year goal, and as wanky as that sounds, it's kind of given a good template, if not a kind of a map. I don't always follow the map, but at least something to aim towards, and kind of ticked off a whole lot of things, doing TV shows or having written this. Or so there are one or two things that are still ahead. I'd love to write something. I know, and I have some great friends, mutual friends of ours, who are fantastic authors, who just look at me and go, don't do it. There's no reason to do it. And there's certainly no financial reason perhaps to do it, but I'd love to write a book of some sort, comic or otherwise. There are one or two musicals. Now, I'm not a musical man and I don't have a great voice, but I've got a good enough kind of performer voice to do one or two of the character parts. So, for example, just before lockdown, I did Max Bialystock in The Producers, and that was meant to come to Joburg and was stopped by COVID. But that was an amazing opportunity. And I feel like there's maybe a Tevye, a Fiddler on the Roof in me somewhere. But you've got to kind of find those new goals, because you do sometimes sit and go, well, what is next now? But I'm going to come back to what I said right at the beginning, which is while I'm playing Salieri and Amadeus, I'm just trying to stay in the moment and enjoy that. So let me finish that 18th of May, and maybe by the 20th of May, I'll have my new list, and then I'll tell you.
I'm pitching you kind of Alan Committee in Cats.
Right.
Alan Committee, yep. Phantom of the Opera.
Phantom of the Opera. I mean, the thought, I'm starting to get shivers down the back of my, I think it's down the back of my throat. Down the back of my throat is where I'm getting the shivers if I think about it.
Just in case Andrew Lloyd Webber is watching, yes, again. Go on. Yes. Give us a line, Phantom of the Opera.
Phantom of the Opera. I'll tell you what I will do.
In
Les Mis. On my own, pretending you're beside me.
Right, beautiful. So we're not doing musicals.
No musicals then. That'll be the end of that.
if tomorrow you know, the world shuts down for whatever reason, we decide that COVID has returned, or Tim Noakes wants us all locked up,
right,
whatever the reason might be, is this a point where you can look back and say, you know what, I've had a hell of a life?
Oh yeah, without a doubt. Absolutely. And again, that's something in the last 10 years I've kind of worked a little bit more at being grateful for, and consciously and mindfully grateful of what I've been able to do, because there are many people who haven't been able to achieve those things or given the opportunity to. And again, you know, I was lucky enough to do stand-up is the one thing that can sell reasonably well in a country like this. And the kind of corporate comedy that I've been able to do has meant that I've been able to then kind of tread waters in other exciting places. So I'm very aware of those luckinesses. It's a good word, English teacher. Can you believe I was an English teacher? And I'm very grateful for it. And if I had to stop today, I'd go, okay, I've done a fair amount. I'm pretty pleased with that.
And at the risk of invoking a little maudlin in you, is there a regret or two?
Maybe that in those early 20s and early 30s, all the way through the 20s and early 30s, that I was so obsessed with just working and getting better and doing stuff that I didn't always recognize what I was able to do and enjoy it. But I think I'm in a space where I'm trying to change that and rectify that. So it's a mild regret, but I'm not a regretty kind of guy. I tend to kind of, you move forward. I always think Peter Turin, who I've been lucky enough to now be in association with at his theaters for, 25, 27 years now, he always said, whatever decision you have to make, you then make that be the right decision. Sometimes there's no good decision. You've got to choose between two awful decisions. You choose one and you make that the right decision. And once you do that, then there can't be any regrets. And that's how I try and live my life.
Well, it's been one that's given us an enormous amount of pleasure. I always love coming to watch you. I've taken my kids to watch your shows. They're still not speaking to me, but I think it's important in the long run. And I love that you've still got such a zest for what you do, because it's quite easy in the world that we live in to get a little bit worn down by it all and lose some of that spark. And yours is only there, but it's infectious. And I'm really grateful for that.
Thank you, Dan.
There we go. Kicking off the Dan Nichols Show podcast, Global International Deluxe Edition. Thank you. And I guess my only final request is just keep being Alan Committee, because you make a lot of us happy through that.
I'd say the exact same thing right back at you.
Alrighty.